Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Net neutrality is the idea that all content on the web is treated equally and that internet service providers can't play favorites with websites. Under the Obama administration, the Federal Communications Commission was able to put some net neutrality rules in place, but the Trump-era FCC has started the process of undoing that work. Net neutrality advocates are planning a day of action, and participating websites such as Twitter, Netflix, and Amazon might look a little different tomorrow. Joining us now is the campaign director for Fight for the Future, the nonprofit planning the online protest, Evan Greer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Can you explain the rules that the FCC put in place during the Obama administration? I understand they actually didn't have a chance to even go into effect.
That's actually not correct.
Okay.
So these rules are in effect, and net neutrality is essentially the First Amendment of the internet. Now, Title II is the legal framework for that. That prevents internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T from engaging in censorship, slowing down certain websites, apps, and services, or charging us all extra fees to access the content that we're used to. So imagine going to Facebook or Twitter or a social media site that you enjoy and seeing a pop-up from your internet service provider saying, you need to upgrade your cable package in order to access this site. That's what's at stake here, and that's what we're trying to prevent with this protest tomorrow.
Big telecommunication companies claim that net neutrality stifles innovation. What do you make of that argument?
So Ajit Pai, the current chairman of the FCC, who's a former top lawyer for Verizon, has cited a study as the main source for his plan to dismantle these rules, that it was recently revealed was secretly funded by the cable industry. Now, that's a perfect example of what you're seeing behind the scenes here. These big companies that are raking in money hand over fist, they're already charging us too much, are claiming that these basic protections hurt their bottom line. But that's actually simply not true. And you can't find a single study that says that, that wasn't funded by those companies themselves.
Then why would they be doing this? I mean, these are kind of like bottom line entities. What's in it for them if it isn't a bottom line issue?
So it is a bottom line issue for them in the sense that they can use this, if they get rid of these protections, to gouge all of us for more money. So it's not that the protections are harming their current level of investment. It's that they would like to squeeze more money out of all of us, out of the websites that we use every day, essentially in a form of extortion. Imagine if you live in a small town and there's a local organized crime unit that can come and threaten to burn down your store if you don't pay them protection money. This is sort of the digital version of that. Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T can go to any startup and say, look, if you don't pay us fees, we're going to slow your website down to the point that your users can barely use it. That's basically what these rules prevent. And if we get rid of them, that's exactly what we're going to see online.
And then on the other side of the coin, they can make it more difficult or charge me a premium to be able to see all of those sites.
That's exactly correct. Imagine your cable bill or your internet bill starting to look more like your cable bill, where you have to pay extra fees to access certain types of content. And the other impact of that is it means that we lose all of the innovative, creative, interesting content that makes the internet that we know and love. The internet becomes more like cable TV, where the only voices that we can hear are those from large corporations or others who can afford to pay. It's essentially a voice for the 1% while the rest of us get completely left out.
Tell us about the day of action you have planned for tomorrow. What are things going to look like?
So we have an incredible amount of momentum right now. More than 75,000 people, websites, organizations have signed on to participate in this day of action, including, again, many of the websites that many of you probably visit every day, Twitter, Netflix, Kickstarter, Etsy, Amazon. And many of these sites will be displaying prominent messages on their homepage that will encourage their visitors to take action by submitting a comment to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is the agency responsible for protecting us in this case, and to Congress. And this is a very important point here, because, again, the current chairman of the FCC has made it very clear that He doesn't want to listen to the public. He's only listening to lobbyists from these big telecom companies. But he answers to Congress, and they are supposed to answer to all of us. So regardless of your political beliefs, this is a point where everyone needs to be calling on their member of Congress to stand up and tell the FCC that they need to listen to the public, the people who will actually be affected by this policy, and not just to these few corporations that are some of the least popular in the United States because they already charge us too much for not enough service.
There's some biggies involved in this, Netflix, Twitter, dating sites, pornography sites. But who's missing from this lineup, in your opinion?
You know, at this point, there's so much momentum. There's so many companies signing on every moment. I couldn't even tell you, I'd have to really look at a list to try to figure out if anyone's missing or who's missing. I think the most important thing is that the press tends to focus on those big names, the Amazons, Netflixes, and Kickstarters, mm-hmm. et cetera, of the world. But in reality, for those of us that organize these online demonstrations, we often see that a bulk of the traffic, the activity, the actual activism comes from those more interesting, alternative, diverse nooks and crannies of the internet, whether it's online gamers or forums where people discuss politics. The internet has created so much more information and creativity and innovation for all of us than we've ever had before. And that's really what's at stake here. It's not just about these big companies. It's not just about tech companies. This is something that affects every single one of us. If you buy something online, if you use services, you're going to be affected by this. It'll hit you in your pocketbook. So it's really a bread and butter issue for every American and something that people should really be paying attention to and educating themselves about.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Evan Greer, but I thought I read that some of the participants in the Day of Action will show examples of how their websites would operate potentially under this different process.
Yeah, it's really fantastic to see so much creativity coming from websites and lots of, we're definitely hearing from some that are planning to kind of show in creative ways what their sites might look like without these protections. We at Fight for the Future are also providing simple code that websites can add that will display some sort of example. So, for example, you could go to a site and see a pop-up that says, you need to upgrade your internet service package in order to access this site. And then below that, it says, okay, just kidding, but if we lose net neutrality, that could actually happen. Click here to submit a comment to the FCC. So that's the kind of example of how sites are sort of educating their users about how this could affect them and then giving them a meaningful way to make their voice heard in this proceeding that will have a profound effect on this technology that's really had such a democratizing effect on our society and our economy.
Your organization, Fight for the Future, organized a similar Day of Action against the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, a copyright enforcement bill. What was at stake there?
So SOPA was called a copyright bill, but really it was a censorship bill. And that's actually exactly what's at stake here as well. Without net neutrality protections, these bright line rules that prevent companies like Comcast and Verizon from blocking online content, they could actually engage in outright censorship by blocking sites that they don't like or that compete with services that they own. So it's actually a very similar issue. It's very much about the future of the internet, the future of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. We showed with SOPA, the online censorship bill, that when the internet comes together, we can stop this type of bad policy that harms the internet and harms freedom of speech. And that's exactly what we intend to do again tomorrow.
Were you successful with the SOPA?
We absolutely were. That was a bill that everyone said was destined to pass. And through grassroots online mobilization, we turned it into one of the most toxic pieces of legislation in modern history. And essentially overnight took a bill that was destined to pass. And it's now in the dustbin forever, likely. I think with net neutrality, similarly, a couple years ago, the FCC was heading in the wrong direction, and we organized a protest called the Internet Slowdown that drove more than 700,000 comments to the FCC in a single day, hundreds of thousands of phone calls to members of Congress, and that got them to change course and listen to the public in that case as well. Millions of people from across the political spectrum spoke out for these rules that we have now, And it's really outrageous that this FCC is moving so quickly to take them away without actually listening to the people who will be affected.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the FCC answers to Congress. Who are you getting support for this from both sides of the aisle?
You know, the cable companies have spent a tremendous amount of money trying to turn this into a partisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most dangerous things here. This is not a partisan issue. It's a basic principle of how the internet was founded and what's made it into what it is today. And if you talk to any technologist, Tim Berners-Lee, the person that actually helped invent the World Wide Web as we know it today, they'll tell you that this isn't about politics. It's about technology. It's about how this technology works.
Yeah, but do the politicians get it?
Right. And so, unfortunately, again, the cable companies have been spending a tremendous amount of time lobbying, trying to turn this into a partisan issue. So what we're seeing right now is that this current Republican-run FCC is sort of posturing against net neutrality. And members of Congress are sort of staying quiet, I think, because they realize that the polling shows that voters from across the political spectrum, including Republican voters, mm-hmm. overwhelmingly support these rules. No one wants their cable company to have control over what they can see and do on the internet. And that includes Republicans, Democrats, independents, you name it. And so, outside of Washington, D.C., this is not a partisan issue. And lawmakers inside Washington, D.C. need to wake up and realize that before they realize that they've been labeled by their constituents as enemies of the internet and enemies of freedom of speech.
Where is the FCC in this process to put the kibosh on net neutrality rules?
So the reason we have our protest tomorrow is that it's 5 days before the July 17th comment deadline. That's the initial deadline for comments into the FCC giving feedback on their proposal to repeal these protections that, again, millions of people fought for. After that, there will be a reply period where people can continue submitting comments in reply to that those initial round of comments. I know this is a little wonky, but bear with me. And then sometime in the fall is when we would be seeing a potential vote from the FCC on this. That said, their process has been plagued by serious issues. Their website has crashed multiple times. They've failed to address a flood of fraudulent comments against net neutrality that were submitted using real people's names and addresses without their permission, likely by an entity potentially funded by the cable companies. So there's a lot of issues here that the FCC needs to deal with. And in my opinion, they should be slowing down and actually taking the time to do this right and listen to the public instead of rushing forward to get rid of these rules that are working well, that are not causing any problems, and that are protecting every single user of the internet.
And just to be clear, the day of action you've planned for tomorrow, you're asking internet users to contact their members, their representatives in Congress, not the FCC?
It's both.
Both.
So
okay.
The tools that we've created allow you to, just with just a couple of clicks at battleforthenet.com, to submit a comment to the FCC, send it to your member of Congress okay. as well, and make a phone call. So we're trying to make it easier for people to participate in this process without having to be, a telecom nerd to figure it out. If you've ever gone to the FCC website and tried to submit a comment, it feels a little bit like you're inside a Kafka novel. And we're trying to make that more accessible to the general public.
What policy would you like to see in place for net neutrality? I mean, this could happen over and over and over again over time, as long as it's not etched in stone anywhere, right?
So the Title II-based rules that we have now are working. They are the most legally sound rules. The reason they're
rules
is because the courts have said repeatedly that this is the only way for the FCC to enforce this. So really, the Congress and the FCC needs to leave the internet alone. These rules are in place. They're legally codifying the guiding principle that has made the internet into what it is today, and they're working. So what we would like to see is for Congress and the FCC to keep their hands off the internet as it is, leave it alone. It's working well. Everyone loves it. Let's keep this platform for freedom of expression and social change going that keeps our economy running as well.
I would think, I mean, I'm surprised that you don't want them codified or something outside of the rulemaking process, which is so, it's obviously it's the Trump administration hasn't even been around for 6 months, and they're already having this kind of an impact.
So here's the thing. Outside of the FCC, you then go to Congress.
Right.
members of Congress have collectively taken hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from these telecom companies, right? And, you know, I don't think internet users are ready at this point, especially not after members of Congress voted to gut their internet privacy rules just a few months ago, to trust this Congress, especially this Congress, to do anything that would actually make this situation better. The best thing that Congress and the FCC can do right now is leave these legally sound rules in place so that they can continue protecting internet users the way that they have since they went into effect.
All right. Evan Greer, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Evan Greer is the campaign director for Fight for the Future, and their day of action is planned for tomorrow. So if you notice anything funky with the internet, that might be why. You can learn more about it with a link from at our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In a world of phishing scams and cyber hacks, digital security and personal information protection are more important than ever. Strong passwords are a good defense, but the more recent gold standard for protection has been something called two-factor authentication. Once enabled, sites require verification from two devices, such as a smartphone and a laptop, before access is granted. But even this measure may not be enough, as hackers always seem to be a step ahead. Joining us now is tech reporter for The Verge, Russell Brandom. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so I know what the two-factor authentication is, but maybe other people who don't necessarily work in a large organization like I do don't know.
Can you
just give us a description about how it works?
Yeah, so essentially, everyone's probably had the experience of you go to a website or a service, and it says, you know, give us your username and your password, right? And then usually you click on the button, give it the things, and then you go right in. Two-factor says we're going to add an extra step where after you give us the password, we're going to send you a little code, and then, you know, usually it's sort of a six-digit number, and then you put in the number, and then it says, okay, now you can go in. And sometimes the number comes in through an app on your phone, or they text it to you, or, you know, sometimes there's a physical device and they just say, put this device in your computer and then hit the button and then we'll trust it to you. But basically, it's just sort of a second step. And the main point of it is, if someone gets your password for whatever reason, we've all heard about these breaches, sometimes passwords are shared between services. If anyone has your password, it means that they can't just automatically get your account, right? Because they wouldn't be able to get this code.
Yeah. And then if it's something where I have it that goes to my phone, they'd have to have my phone there. And then you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How widely adopted is two-factor authentication? I called it the gold standard, but is it really that widely adopted?
So it's available in a lot of services. And this is part of what the piece is about, is I think around 5 years ago, there was really this push of, you know, then as now people were seeing a lot of account hacks, and there's a lot of concern over, you know, what can I do to keep my information that's in all these places, what can I do to keep it safe? And two-factor was kind of the best thing, and not a lot of services at the time were offering it. Now, basically every major service offers some form of it. And so, you know, your Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, all of those, if you say, some of them call it different things, it's like login authentication, but generally if you say, I want two-factor, there will be somewhere in the settings page where you can turn it on, and they'll have some version of it that they can give you. Now, not a lot of users actually take advantage of that, and I would certainly encourage anyone who's worried about their account being hacked, or even if you're only somewhat worried, it's definitely a very good thing to do, and it's not that much more trouble to log in.
Is it expensive?
Oh, no, it's free.
Okay.
I mean, so usually, now if you get into the fancier ones, so I was talking about the device, so I have this little security key, it's like a USB device, and so I don't even need the code when I log into my Gmail, I just put the little USB thing in, which as long as you don't lose the USB thing, it's great, but then you have to buy the USB thing, it's this physical object to have to make, but usually you just click the button, it's totally free.
Now, what companies use it and don't use it of note at this point?
At this point, basically every major company uses it. I think there are a couple sometimes. One of the things that we talk about in the piece is that wireless carriers, your sort of AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, often they'll give you a static number that when you want to make changes, they'll say, well, what's your special PIN number?
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll want that. But and there are weirdly, I think, some financial services that are a little slow. But at this point, it's really the exception for companies not to offer it at all, which is good news for security, certainly.
Mm-hmm. The USB drive that you mentioned seems to be popular among cybersecurity advocates. What are the promises are this extra security, and the pitfall would be just losing it? Are there other issues?
Well, so I mean, I think it's I find it easier because I don't have to wait for the text to come in and do things like that. I think it isn't in the end. So one of the things we talk about in the piece is that texting is a little bit less secure as two-factor methods go. So if you really say, I'm doing important stuff, people may be coming after my emails for whatever reason, you may want a sort of a more secure option. And it's very difficult to get away from texting at all. And so the concern with texting is if anyone can get into your AT&T or Verizon account, mm-hmm. then often they can set up a call forwarding thing and end up getting the code even if they don't have your phone. And that's not true of the security key. Like, you really do need this physical object. But it's a little tricky. Like, usually you can just tell the service, oh, hey, I lost my security key. Can you just send me the code over text? And they'll, typically do it because they still consider it a two-factor thing. So the downside of the security key, I would say, is it does sort of cost a little bit, and you have to – I think it's like $14 for one of these things, which, that's a couple lunches. In some ways, it doesn't necessarily make you more secure than the texting option would.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Russell Brandom, a tech reporter for Verge.com. He's been writing about two-factor authentication, the pros and cons, what works, what doesn't. If you have a question or comment for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that two-factor began to unravel starting in 2014. What happened again? What are some of the ways that hackers can get around the security?
So one of the main things we see is going after the phone carrier accounts, where I go to, your account with AT&T or Verizon that you maybe don't use very often. If you can get into that, and especially since a lot of those don't have two-factor, then a lot of the times you can get the two-factor messages that are being sent.
Okay.
Now, that's still more work because the person has two-factor. So I think one of the things I was careful to say in the piece is it's definitely more security you're getting for doing this. And I would definitely encourage everyone to get two-factor on their accounts, particularly sensitive ones like email and sort of social networking. There's also, in many cases, it can be there's sort of a scenario you can go through where if you go to an account and you say, I lost my I forgot my password. Can you just reset everything and give me the new password? And they'll ask you some things, but often you go to these sort of account recovery questions where they say, oh, well, what was your first pet called and where did you go to high school and things like that, which are often very easy for people to just look up this information.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be hard to tell how secure those processes are. And there's often a way around it that's not immediately obvious to the outside, but criminals have become very good at finding those. And I would also say that's particularly true for services. You would think of them as maybe high-value services. So if you own any sort of digital currency like Bitcoin or things like that,
mm-hmm.
they're always very interested because if they can get the account, they can just take all your money and be gone and you'll never get it back. Anyone who talks about Bitcoin or talks about owning Bitcoin, often they look for statements like that on social media. And then a lot of the time you see people who had two-factor on the account, but they knew that if they could break it, there would be thousands of dollars waiting for them on the other end. So they find a way through.
Yeah, you mentioned some big shot, you know, had a lot of Bitcoin and lost it.
Yeah. I mean, this is always and it's the worst feeling usually when you're hacked, because a lot of time, you know, if someone gets into your email or your Facebook, I think a more common hack might be, and this happened to a family member of mine actually, that someone got into their Facebook account and then started messaging their friends asking for money, saying, mm-hmm. I'm stuck in this foreign airport. I lost my wallet. Can you wire me money at this location?
Right.
And I most of her friends thankfully were savvy enough that they didn't do it, but it's very embarrassing to have someone, suddenly you can imagine how you would feel to sort of wake up and realize all these people that you know have gotten this email from you this Facebook message that's not true. And then you have to go back and say, don't do this. I've been hacked. I'm sorry. And so that, I think, is a really good example of where, you definitely want the two-factor verification to sort of ensure that can't happen. But also, there are these other – we want to make sure that two-factor authentication is as strong as it can be. And I think that's sort of where – companies are maybe falling short. I think they're looking at it and they're saying, oh, well, not enough people are using this, and they want to get more people using it, which is certainly good. But I worry that we've made it a little bit too easy to break through.
That's always going to be the problem, isn't it, Russell?
Oh, yeah, certainly. And I think, one of the responses to the piece from sort of people building these systems mm-hmm. is, it's all very well and good for we wrote it on The Verge, and I think it's a fairly sort of tech-savvy crowd. Mm-hmm. And I think they say, well, it's all very well and good for you guys to say you want something stronger. I'm trying to get everyone who uses Facebook to use something that's harder to hack. And you guys are in the little 1% that's already using two-factor, and you want the two-factor to be stronger, but I'm worried about the other 99% that's not using anything at all. Which I think is completely legitimate. I mean, I think in some ways we don't have to choose. We can make everything better. But I do think, if you're looking for one takeaway from all of this, I would mm-hmm. definitely say turn on two-factor in your important accounts. But I also think we can push to make two-factor itself even stronger.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Brandom, a tech reporter for Verge.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My problem with two-factor authentication is I travel a lot internationally, and usually it seems this stuff wants to send me a message onto my cell phone. When I'm overseas, I don't have an overall plan with my carrier, because that's like $100 a month, every mm-hmm. month.
Oh, yeah.
It's too much. So I'll buy a $20 chip. It'll work for a couple of weeks. I don't use the internet. I don't use the phone, very little, if any, but mostly just the internet while I'm traveling. But every time I do that, I have a new phone number, so it doesn't work. What do I do?
So I would encourage you to get a two-factor app. So Google Authenticator is one popular one, and I think Authy is the other. That's Authy. But so these are – it's sort of generating code. So every, I think, 15 seconds, it'll give you a new six-digit code. And it's not getting them from the internet. It's generating them locally. But it's synced to the app, so they always work, and you don't necessarily it's just sort of a local app running on your phone. So that should work without service, and it'll let you synchronize without needing a data plan. I run into this a lot of where people will sort of go on vacation or camping out of town, and they want to check their email, but they don't have internet access on their phone, they don't have cell service,
mm-hmm.
right? Which I think happens a lot,
mm-hmm.
and you still want to be able to get into your email somehow. But I would also say those apps are significantly more secure than getting the text over SMS also.
Mike, thanks for that question. So if two-factor isn't a solution, what's next then?
So this is the tricky thing. I think one of the things I found when I started asking companies about this is they're really looking outside the login page. They're sort of looking at a broader picture of what do we know about the people who are coming to sort of put these passwords in, and what can we tell from that to see maybe this login we should be a little bit more skeptical of, because you know, either it's coming from this suspicious IP address, or we're actually seeing this same person put in, you know, 1,000 passwords a minute, and so that seems like maybe it's an automated thing and not a human being. And you know, those are just the simple ones. I think it gets way more complicated once you start putting these big machine learning algorithms against the task. But that's one of the things they're really looking at, and they seem very excited about it. And I think it's very effective by whatever metric they're using. The thing that's, and again, I think this is the question of how do we build a system that protects everyone, right? The thing that makes me a little nervous about it is, as a customer of Facebook and Gmail and all these services, mm-hmm. I can't really tell how well it's working. So they seem very excited about it and seem to think it's giving this great security benefit, but it's very hard for me to tell how. Well, I mean, I suppose I can take them at their word, but it's a little tricky because more and more of these things are moving kind of behind the curtain, where you don't really know how well it's working.
It's just gotten to the point where even if someone sends me something saying, don't click on this link or click on this link to avoid this or that, I don't click on anything that I don't absolutely know is absolutely whatever.
I think that's good. I think that's a very good practice. I will say, I mean, I've gotten... I got a new landlord. I moved my apartment, and then suddenly, the first time rent was due, some email person that I've never heard from sent me just this. It was a complete blank email, and it said to Russell Brandom, and there was no text, and then it just had a link to the PDF. And I said, "Who are you? What is this?" I didn't open the PDF. It turned out the PDF was just my rent bill, and everything was fine. But I think, you know, it's often very cheap and doesn't hurt you at all to sort of respond to people and say, wait, what is this? Like, just let's give it a little bit of baseline skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that's an ounce of prevention beats a pound of cures, they say.
Yeah, I swear that's half of what Tech Tuesday is these days, is how to avoid getting hacked.
Well, I mean, two-factor is still the best advice we have, yeah. I would say. Even with folks like me saying bad things about it, I would say it's still, if you're asking that question, it's still the best answer we have.
Better than nothing. Well, Russell Brandom, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You can check out Russell Brandom's article about the two-factor authentication in The Verge. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You might not know it, but today is Amazon Prime Day. A 30-hour event is designed to boost sluggish summer sales with discounts on thousands of products. Joining us now to talk about whether the deals live up to the hype and tech news in general is Managing Editor of Android Central, Daniel Bader. Welcome back to the show, Daniel.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
So Prime Day started last night at 9 p.m., what are we seeing so far?
Echo. Amazon wants you to buy their Echo, and that is something that is not changing. But this is, it's so interesting that this piece of hardware that Amazon came out with in 2014 is now the primary vehicle for its Prime Day discounts. You can buy the Amazon Echo for $90. It's the cheapest it's ever been. And this is really the cornerstone of Amazon's hardware strategy now. It wants you to have as many Amazon-branded products as possible, in addition to, obviously, all of the other gadgets and discounted things like jewelry and clothing that you can buy on a regular Amazon day.
It's like the Model T of delivery, or at least order systems.
Absolutely. It's so interesting because Prime is a subscription service, and if you've heard anything about the direction that online, e-commerce is moving over the last 5 years or so, people are, you know, if you think about anything from Netflix, you know, $10 a month to Spotify, another $10 a month, Prime is $100 a year, but it's these recurring revenue schemes that help companies like Amazon, even though Amazon is certainly not hurting for revenue, mm-hmm. get to the next level. And with so many millions of Americans subscribing to Prime, this is really not a niche thing anymore. Prime Day is a shopping event. It's you know, not quite Black Friday, but it's certainly getting there.
So Echo, 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 anything else that's of interest?
Sure. I mean, you look at the what I find really interesting is that this is a 30-hour event, and that is actually, you know, literally what it means. There, the deals are changing from hour to hour, and Amazon wants you to check back in like a blog throughout the day. You know, you check the NPR website, you check Amazon, you check whatever. That's the kind of thing that Amazon wants you to do. You know, you're looking at something like a Roomba if you've been looking for one of those robotic vacuums to scare your pet as it cleans the house. Then you get one for, you know, $250. That's a significant discount. You can get things like a pressure cooker, something that I've been looking at. My wife looks at me crazy when I mention I want a pressure cooker. You can get one for $90. And obviously you can get these. When you think of Amazon, you think of cheap electronics. You think of, you know, SD cards. Everybody wants the cheapest storage, the cheapest external hard drives. You can get a PlayStation 4 for $230. These are things that you come to expect from Amazon, but you really cannot get them any cheaper anywhere else.
So it's not just hype. It really is a great way to save money if you're already in the market for one of these things. If you're not, well, you're going broke saving money.
That's the thing. I have a shopping cart of six things that I really don't need, and I've been coming back to it the last couple of hours going, do I need that set of durable cups when I look in my cupboard and I have 24 cups already? So this is the thing. Prime Day, it's different from going to a store because you don't get to try it first. You can easily return things, which is great, but Amazon is really making it super easy to spend money you don't have or don't need to spend. And there's a lot of avenues here that it can get your money. For example, it's really moving into subscriptions within Prime itself. So, for example, you buy things like toilet paper, a lot of renewables, things that you know you'll buy from Costco or somewhere else. Amazon's becoming a great replacement for these Sam's Warehouse, Costco-type stores where you're buying things on a regular basis. And it's become the de facto replacement for many big box warehouse retailers as well.
Is there anyone else out there that competes with, Prime Day?
Well, certainly from a technology perspective, Best Buy does really well on Black Friday, but Amazon does. Amazon's the only retailer that can come close to offering this kind of experience on a single day that is not shared by any other retailer. Walmart is certainly probably the next biggest competitor, but its e-commerce doesn't come nearly as close to Amazon just from a scale perspective. It can't offer things like movie streaming, music. The Prime type extras are what get people in the door and what get people not minding spending $100 a year.
Any advice for those Prime shoppers out there today on how they should go about this?
Yeah, I mean, if you really, the timed deals are probably your best bet for crazy discounts. If you are looking for something in a particular category, don't be afraid to dig into the categories themselves. They're very deep. You can spend hours browsing it, but you will find great deals. The lightning deals as well have shown themselves to be quite effective. And really, if you are just looking for one or two things, make sure to stick to that and then buy it and leave, because you will spend more money at that than you want to. And especially on bigger tag items, like if you want to buy a PlayStation 4, that's $230. That's a lot of money. If you find other things, little knickknacks to put in the cart, you may not buy the PlayStation, but you may spend an equivalent $230 just on things that you don't really need. So buy that thing you wanted and then leave. That's my biggest advice.
Let me ask you this before we move on. If you can load up a cart, you can take advantage of the momentary deals by loading up your cart, but then you can get rid of them later if you have second thoughts.
If it doesn't sell out.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. It'll let you. Oh, okay. All right. Good to know.
So I had something in my cart that I wanted, and I went back to it this morning, and it the price was already back to normal for me because it ran out of stock.
Okay. All right. Good to know. Hey, in other news, you can't get this on Amazon yet, but automaker Tesla has released its electronic car for the masses, the Model 3. For those who don't know, tell us about Tesla and their cars again.
So Tesla is probably the most well-known car manufacturer in the world right now, even though it's certainly the newest. The Model 3 is a $35,000 four-door sedan that Tesla has been teasing for over a year now. And the first model, a black model, as you mentioned, the Model T, it's certainly an homage to the first car that rolled off the line from Ford over 100 years ago. This Model 3 is going to be one of the more popular electric cars ever made. Certainly has more competition now than it did a year ago when it was announced. Companies like GM and Ford are releasing pretty good electric cars. The Chevy Bolt, for example, is a great option. But a $35,000 Tesla is something that the mainstream has been waiting for. Its cars have been over $70,000, $60,000 to $70,000 base for the last few years. So this is something that people only had to put $1,000 down on when they pre-ordered it, when it was announced. And the earliest orders should be getting theirs in the next few months. They're really ramping up quite slowly to get any kinks worked out of the manufacturing process. It's a very, very new product for Tesla, and CEO Elon Musk is very transparent about working out these problems in real time. If there are issues with the manufacturing, he will stop the line. He will make sure that everything is fixed. He will go there, inspect things himself. He's very hands-on, and he shares a lot of those experiences with the public. So people feel personal connection to him and to Tesla, and people who have put down that $1,000 are awaiting eagerly their delivery of the Model 3.
You know, I've seen Teslas on the road now. They look like really awesome, beautiful cars. Is the Model 3 going to have that sort of luxe feel to it?
You know, we don't know. We don't have a lot of information. That's something that Tesla's kept very close to the chest. Just from the outside, the car looks quite modern. It does have that sleek look that many coupes have, but it's a sedan, and it does feel quite aerodynamic. I haven't been inside it personally, but I've seen it from seen it from the outside, and it's an impressive and imposing looking car that does look more expensive than its $35,000 base would suggest. The other problem is that we really don't know just how much that minimum 250-mile range is going to be beaten. Elon Musk teased this minimum mile spec, saying that it won't quite reach the heights of the Model X and the Model S, but 250 miles is just about what its smaller battery can do. And with optimizations and something that no other car company can do on a regular basis, software updates, it'll get updates over the years to improve battery performance. This may actually help the minimum spec increase over time, which is something that, you know, you really could not take for granted from any other car company.
I think what's mostly amazing about this is you have people willing to spend quite a lot of money. Again, $35,000 is not, it's not chump change. It's not 150 or 75, though, on something they haven't even seen.
Yes, and that's because Elon Musk has the Steve Jobs type of loyalty. And there's something about Tesla where it's almost like a computer company that makes cars, mm-hmm. right? You have this expectation that every product that it makes will be great, and people will line up from day one and put down a considerable amount of money to purchase one. The difference is the scale. For example, when people line up for an iPhone, they line up for an $800 device. This is a $35,000 car that has takes a significant investment. Of course, with an electric car, you're not paying the same amount in maintenance and gas over time. And Tesla's shown itself to have invested considerably in these superchargers, the quick battery chargers that will top up your car in a couple of hours instead of overnight like you would in your garage. So these are things that Tesla is building an infrastructure around North America and in the U.S. especially to make it easier to justify these kinds of large purchases.
Now to the world of smartphones. BlackBerry can't get a break. It released its Key One phone this spring, but questions about its durability have caused a lot of negative press. What's been going on?
Well, the phone broke apart very easily. If you took the phone in your two hands and you just sort of put some pressure on it, the screen popped out. And the story here isn't so much that BlackBerry is making changes to its manufacturing process. It's that a single YouTuber made this happen. A guy by the name of Zach, he runs a YouTube channel, quite popular, about a million followers, called Jerry Rig Everything. And that's his job. He takes phones apart. He scratches them. He tests their durability claims. And with this single break, he basically forced BlackBerry to change its manufacturing to make its phone more durable. And it just goes to show that some of these YouTubers have so much power in changing the market. There's YouTubers with millions of followers, and people will listen to their every word, and the phone companies do as well. And this just speaks to the influence that some of these guys have, these people have.
Now that's very interesting. In general, though, how does the BlackBerry Key One stack up against other smartphones? How's it doing?
It's very good. The company can't keep them in stock. What I'm hearing is that they're having trouble manufacturing them in on scale to keep up with demand, and it's not sold at any U.S. carriers. But somehow the company just cannot make enough of them. This is a very nostalgic phone for a lot of people. It's the BlackBerry that a lot of people who used them in the mid-2000s have wanted for 10 years. So it's going to have a big upfront demand. Whether it's sustainable, I don't know. I personally don't think so. I've seen it. I've used it. It's fine. It's a BlackBerry with running Android. It's not my bag, really, but mm-hmm. It's a good product for a lot of people, and it's not that expensive. It's $550, which to the average consumer may seem like a lot, but this is not being aimed at them. It's aimed at the executives, the CEOs, the people who used BlackBerries 10 years ago and want to go back to it.
Yeah, I mean, does it have those the keys that you can feel, the whatever you call it?
Oh, yeah. It's got the hardware keyboards. Yeah. Very tactile. It feels great. It feels like the BlackBerry Bold that you or I used back in 2008. And that's really the main draw here is it's very nostalgic. It looks like a BlackBerry. It feels hefty. You can throw this thing at a wall as long as the screen doesn't pop out, and you should be fine.
Last year, we were talking about the Galaxy Note 7, Samsung's fiery smartphones, catching fire, banned in airports, blah, blah, blah. Now the company's releasing refurbished versions of the phone called the Galaxy Note Fan Edition. Is this for all the people who just couldn't bear to part with their Galaxy Note 7s and had to be forced to?
So interesting. Yeah, this is a phone that won't go away. Even though the Note 8 is expected about a month from now, the Note 7 just had so many people lusting after it. It had the right combination of design and power. Everybody who had to give theirs up really missed it. That's what I heard. I felt it myself. I really didn't want to send my phone back. So Samsung did the thing that a few thousand people are willing to do. They released a refurbished version, battery guaranteed not to explode in your pocket, and it has a smaller battery to compensate. So obviously the issue with the last phone was that the batteries were too big for the chassis. They butted up against the other electronics, and if put in a certain situation, it may explode. These ones won't, and they're only available in South Korea right now. They're only making a few thousand of them, as the Fan Edition moniker would suggest, but they may roll it out in North America if there's enough demand, so who knows.
Okay. Daniel Bader, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Bader, Managing Editor of Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.